The world and everything in it is made possible by people like me. I am Brad Sullivan, and I'm the superintendent of a public school district in Arkansas. As an educator, I know the importance of news and information from a biblical worldview. A good education opens up doors for students in this world, but the knowledge of Christ opens the doors of heaven. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
Good morning. The Federal Trade Commission has a new leader, and she's gunning for big tech.
The new chair of the FTC will not necessarily benefit consumers. That will benefit those less efficient competitors.
Also, a campus Christian group chalks up a big win for free speech and religious liberty. Plus, a love of sound.
What acoustic recording is using sound pressure to record with without the aids of microphones or electronics.
And Cal Thomas on celebrating hard work and personal achievement.
It's Thursday, July 22nd. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Paul Butler. Good morning.
Up next, Ken Covington has today's news.
Senate Republicans Wednesday blocked a motion to begin debate on a roughly $1 trillion infrastructure bill. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said Democrats were trying to rush a vote on a bill that wasn't ready.
There's no outcome yet, no bipartisan agreement, no text, nothing for the Congressional Budget Office to evaluate, and certainly nothing on which to vote.
Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the attempt to advance the incomplete bill was an effort to, in his words, get the ball rolling. He said lawmakers could fill in the gaps later.
If you're serious about getting a bipartisan bill done, there's no good reason not to support the starting the process now.
The Republican filibuster blocked the vote on Wednesday, but both sides said they're still optimistic. An informal bipartisan group of 22 senators said in the statement, quote, "We have made significant progress and are close to a final agreement." The nearly $1 trillion measure over 5 years includes almost $600 billion in new spending on roads, broadband, and other public works projects. Democrats, however, are planning to follow it with a much broader $3.5 trillion second measure next month. They plan to pass that bill in the Senate without any Republican votes using budget reconciliation. Smoke and ash from massive wildfires in the west are now clouding skies in the east. Miles Bliss with the National Weather Service.
As the smoke rises through the cloud and then enters the atmosphere above that and slowly drifts east, it just carries across the country and slowly spreads out, forming sort of this haze layer in the sky.
Strong winds on Wednesday blew smoke east from California, Oregon, and other states all the way to the other side of the continent, creating hazy skies as far east as New York City. Officials told people in parts of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere with asthma and other health issues to try to stay indoors. Air quality alerts for parts of the region are in place through this evening. The nation's largest wildfire, Oregon's Bootleg Fire, has grown to more than 600 square miles. That is just over half the size of Rhode Island. Fires also burned on both sides of California's Sierra Nevada and in Washington State and other areas of the West. South Korea has reported a new pandemic high for daily coronavirus cases. World's Anna Johansson Brown reports.
South Korean officials on Wednesday confirmed 1,800 new cases in a 24-hour period, the country's biggest single-day jump yet. The nation is now nearing 200,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. South Korea's caseload has been climbing in recent days, and analysts say there are three reasons for that: a slow vaccination rate, a public that has let its guard down, and the spread of the more contagious Delta variant. A majority of new cases are in the crowded Seoul metropolitan area, but officials warn that the virus is spreading beyond the capital region. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson Brown.
Life expectancy in the United States last year suffered its steepest decline since World War II. It fell by a year and a half to 77 years and 4 months. That, according to a new report from the CDC, it said COVID-19 was the main reason, accounting for 74% of the decline. Drug overdoses were another big culprit. An increase in homicides also contributed. Life expectancy for Black Americans and Hispanic Americans fell by about 3 years. For white Americans, it fell by 14 months. Overall, the country recorded 3.3 million deaths. That is the largest number in U.S. history. First Lady Jill Biden embarked Wednesday on her first solo international trip as First Lady. She's leading a U.S. delegation to the Olympic Games in Tokyo. Press Secretary Jen Psaki said a spate of positive COVID-19 tests at Olympic Village did not alter the First Lady's plans.
And she looks forward to supporting, of course, the athletes who are competing on behalf of the United States. We are monitoring the situation closely. Our team will be following very strict safety and health protocols.
Two South African soccer players and several Olympic staff members tested positive for COVID-19 over the weekend. The International Olympic Committee has warned that it could still pull the plug on the Summer Olympics at the last minute, though that appears unlikely. Some athletes are already competing. The Swedish women's soccer team stunned the United States with a 3-0 victory Wednesday in the women's tournament. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, big plans for big tech. Plus, a 14-year-old girl gives the country a lesson in the benefits of hard work. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Thursday, the 22nd of July, 2021. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Paul Butler. First up, a big tech shakeup. 2 weeks ago, President Biden signed an executive order aimed at cracking down on what he calls anti-competitive practices in big tech. The order includes 72 actions and recommendations involving 12 different agencies.
The Biden administration argues that Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple, and YouTube are unfairly boxing out smaller competitors. He says it's time to do something about it. The powerful new chair of the Federal Trade Commission agrees. And as World's Sarah Schweinsberg reports, she's out to break up big tech.
In April, Lina Khan appeared before the Senate Commerce Committee for her confirmation hearing.
I am deeply honored to have been nominated by President Biden to serve as a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission.
The FTC enforces consumer protection laws that prevent fraud, deception, and unfair business practices. President Biden nominated the 32-year-old to become one of the agency's five commissioners because she shares his viewpoint of big tech. Lina Khan made her name in antitrust circles 4 years ago when she was still a student at Yale Law School. She published an article that argued current antitrust laws are not equipped to properly deal with today's tech giants. She then wrote a report for the House Judiciary Committee that spelled out how Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google are all violating antitrust laws.
Pursuing this investigation underscored the important work that enforcers and lawmakers must do to ensure that longstanding laws are keeping pace with new technologies and reflecting current business realities.
Khan says consumers need to be protected from big tech companies collecting data without consent, and that their size and influence need to be reined in. That idea is an echo of the early 20th century trust busters, who were also concerned about the power of big corporations. Khan's criticism of Silicon Valley has gained her support on both sides of the aisle. Democrats are upset with tech giants for using what they call unfair business practices and for not policing speech enough. And Republicans are critical of big tech for over-policing conservative speech.
Nomination, Federal Trade Commission, Lina M. Khan of New York to be a Federal Trade Commissioner.
Those issues pushed Khan through the Senate with a 69-28 vote, with top Republicans bucking their traditional aversion to more government regulation. Those included Senators Chuck Grassley of Iowa, John Thune of South Dakota, Susan Collins of Maine, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Soon after the vote, President Biden promoted Lina Khan to chair the Federal Trade Commission. Arulian Porchways directs antitrust and innovation policy at the nonpartisan Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. He says chairing the FTC is a powerful position.
At least the chair is a very strategic position in order to change the enforcement strategies and priorities. And the chair also some impetus for making new rules.
Khan has already made important changes to how the agency functions. She led commissioners to kill the requirement that a majority must sign off on an investigation into a company. Now just one commissioner can order an investigation. Commissioners also tossed out an Obama-era FTC statement that the agency must follow antitrust law precedents set by the courts. Aurelien Porchue says for years, those precedents have focused on protecting consumers, not other competitors.
The FTC has reneged on its promise to stick to the consumer welfare standard, which has been the criterion for antitrust analysis over the last few decades. And so therefore, there is no clear compass that the FTC will have to follow. And this brings a much more discretionary power and much more rooms for the FTC to not only enact new rules, but also to enforce it in the way it sees fit.
Porchue says if the FTC pursues breaking up big tech companies on the grounds that they're locking out competition, that would have big implications for the economy.
The new chair of the FTC will focus on protecting smaller companies that may not have a great efficiency or great innovations as the larger companies may have. And that will not necessarily benefit consumers. That will benefit those less efficient competitors.
Porchue also says Silicon Valley giants have actually promoted more market innovation as tech developers jump in the game with hopes of selling their product to an Apple or Facebook someday. But would breaking up big tech have benefits for free speech? Mark Jamieson is the director of the Digital Markets Initiative at the University of Florida.
I think there are some issues there that need to be resolved, but breaking up the companies isn't the answer.
Jamieson argues that these companies can still restrict speech, even if they're smaller. And as consumers demand a platform that doesn't monitor content as much, new giants will rise.
But they won't always be. There are gaps in their business models. There always are. And someone's going to exploit them at some point.
In the meantime, some policy analysts believe Congress could protect speech on massive private platforms. Prasad Krishnamurti specializes in antitrust at Berkeley Law.
When tech platforms become so large that they are effective monopolies and have substantial market power, Congress could do something like pass a statute that prohibits viewpoint discrimination on the largest tech monopolies. That would prevent Facebook and Twitter from blocking Donald Trump.
Now, Lina Khan and Biden's FTC face an uphill road in the courts, which have to approve monopoly breakups. In June, a federal court dismissed a complaint against Facebook brought by the Federal Trade Commission. If the FTC had won, Facebook would have had to sell off Instagram and WhatsApp. The court said the FTC failed to prove that Facebook was indeed a monopoly. Mark Jamieson at the University of Florida says that's a sign that the courts aren't ready to play by the Biden administration's definition of antitrust.
It just said, look, this company has a 60 or 70% market share. It must be bad. And the court said, that's not good enough. You actually have to demonstrate that there's some harm, or at least have a path towards demonstrating there's some harm.
Now the FTC and Lina Khan have to decide whether to refile the case or head back to the antitrust drawing board. Reporting for World, I'm Sarah Schweinsberg.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, discrimination against a Christian campus group. A federal appeals court this past Friday slammed the University of Iowa for punishing InterVarsity Christian Fellowship because it limits leadership to Christians. The court said the school violated the organization's free speech rights.
In a unanimous opinion for the three-judge panel, Circuit Judge Jonathan Kobus wrote, and quote, "We are hard-pressed to find a clearer example of viewpoint discrimination." He noted that the school exempted some groups, like fraternities, sororities, and the gay-affirming Love Works, from the non-discrimination policy, but not religious groups. Here now to discuss the case is Steve West. He's an attorney and writes about religious liberty issues for World Digital. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Myrna.
So this campus Christian group, again called InterVarsity, welcomes all students to attend but limits leadership to those who subscribe to its statement of faith. So what happened here exactly? I mean, the school, I'm guessing, tried to get them to change that policy. How did this controversy unfold?
Well, Myrna, the University of Iowa, like most, if not all, public universities, has a non-discrimination policy that applies to recognized student organizations. But it's not what's called an all-comers policy. That's one where all groups must accept any student as a member or leader. This school permits student groups to require students to subscribe to the goals and beliefs of the group or even have a characteristic that makes sense. Sororities may limit membership to women, an Islamic group to Muslims, the Chinese basketball club to Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it sounds reasonable. What was the problem?
It is reasonable, and until recently, this was non-controversial. InterVarsity had been a recognized group on the campus for 25 years, but in June 2018, the university told student leaders that limiting leadership to Christians violated this non-discrimination policy. Like you said, InterVarsity welcomes all students to join, to attend the meetings, but it limits leadership to those who could sign a statement of basic Christian beliefs, which makes sense as a Christian organization. Mm-hmm. There was an attempt to seek an exemption, but the university would not budge. A few weeks later, the student group was deregistered.
Okay, so when the university deregistered the chapter, well, what did that mean for InterVarsity?
It didn't mean they couldn't exist, but it severely limited them. You know, recognized groups get benefits, including money that comes from student activity fees, participation in university publications, use of the university's trademark, and access to campus facilities, things that are crucial to the life of a student group on campus.
Right. And this wasn't the first time a court has ruled that the University of Iowa wrongly discriminated against a Christian group, correct?
That's right. If you just turn the clock back to 2017 and the roots of this lawsuit become clearer. A student in 2017 filed a complaint against another campus group, Business Leaders for Christ, or In Christ. He was denied a leadership role after refusing to affirm the group's belief that same-sex relationships were against the Bible. And he claimed the decision was because he was gay. So the university agreed and deregistered the group. Business Leaders in Christ filed a lawsuit, and a federal judge agreed with the group and entered an order barring the school from deregistering the group. But, you know, rather than stand down, the university began a review of all student groups for compliance with the school policy, and reviewers were told to, quote, look at religious student groups first, end quote, for language that required leaders to affirm certain religious beliefs. That was a clear targeting of religious groups, and InterVarsity was caught up in this review. And at the same time, the school exempted sororities and fraternities from the non-discrimination requirements.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand. The school proceeded in spite of the fact that a judge had found they were selectively enforcing the policy?
That's right, Myrna. And that's why the appeals court in both cases, the one involving Business Leaders in Christ as well as this one involving InterVarsity, concluded that school officials were not immune from personal liability for damages for what they did. Basically, they knew what they were doing was unconstitutional, and they proceeded anyway.
Well, now in some places, state laws or local ordinances seek to prioritize things like LGBT accommodations over religious liberty. Is that the case in Iowa?
There's certainly a clash in Iowa, as well as many other places, over gay rights and free exercise of religion and free speech rights. And that'll continue to be the subject of many lawsuits, whether it's a faith-based student group or an adoption agency or a baker who declines to design a custom cake for a same-sex wedding. There's just an aggressive move to eliminate all public disagreement with the gay rights agenda. And the academy, university administrators, are caught up in this agenda.
Mm-hmm. And this also wasn't the first time that InterVarsity won a legal fight like this. I understand they faced a similar battle at another university.
That's right. For similar reasons, InterVarsity was kicked off the campus of Michigan's Wayne State University in 2017 after 75 years of ministry there. In April, a federal court ruled against school officials there. So there have been three wins for campus ministries. So we can hope that administrators get the message. The First Amendment is first for a reason.
Well, Steve West writes about religious liberties for World Digital. You can read his work at wng.org. You can also subscribe to his free weekly newsletter on First Amendment issues, liberties. Steve, always great talking to you.
My pleasure, Myrna.
Additional support comes from Alliance Defending Freedom, dedicated to protecting God-given rights, including helping ministry leaders navigate religious freedom issues. Free legal guide available at ministryebook.com.
A British man has fulfilled a lifelong dream of getting his name in the Guinness Book of World Records. Will Cutbill, a civil engineer, just set a record by engineering the world's tallest stack of M&Ms. A whopping 5 candy pieces stacked one on top of the other. Now that shattered the previous M&M stacking record of 4 pieces. The resident of suburban Birmingham, England, told CNN he knows stacking 5 candy pieces doesn't sound that impressive, but to those who doubt the difficulty of the feat, Cutbill says, you give it a go.
So it's a lot harder than it looks. They're not as flat as you think. They're quite spherical.
It took him hours and countless failed attempts, but Cutbill finally set the new world record. And Myrna, how do you think he celebrated his triumph?
He's going to Disneyland.
No, with a candy feast.
As soon as the record was broken, I've got to admit, I did eat them all.
It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Thursday, July 22nd. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Paul Butler. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, antique audio recordings. Now, compared to writing and printing, the ability to capture the human voice and play it back is a relatively recent invention. It's only been around for about 150 years, and one of the earliest pioneers was American inventor Thomas Edison. World intern Caleb Bailey spent a few weeks in North Central Illinois last month, and he stumbled upon an audio recording enthusiast who's keeping Edison's techniques alive.
In an upstairs apartment in downtown Princeton, Illinois, recordings like this play around the clock. But these records aren't the black flat discs you're familiar with. Audio historian Sean Borey.
We're going to be listening to some 5-inch records. This one dates from 1903.
The cylinders are 4.5-inch tubes of wax. They look like a candle with the middle board out. The cylinders are played without electricity on Edison phonographs, invented in the late 19th century.
He didn't like it, discs very much. He was a cylinder guy.
Thomas Edison's love for cylinders was contagious. Borey took an early interest in cylinders and the acoustic playback device.
Save canned money, and I'd buy antique stuff. And so I was about 12 or between 11 and 13. I'm not sure exactly how old I was, but I bought that machine and had to do a lot of work to it. Had to fix the spring. The spring was broken in it.
A self-taught mechanic and avid reader, Borey learned the ins and outs of the complex machine and began to collect as many pieces as he could. Eventually, Borey transformed this hobby into a business. He adopted the name the North American Phonograph Company from the original owners, who went bankrupt in 1894.
The purpose is to buy, sell, rent, lease, and acquire and dispose to persons and corporations the rights to use devices that record sound.
I am the Edison Concert Phonograph, created for the great wizard of the new world.
Borey shares his love of the Edison phonograph and wax cylinders with everyone he can. He takes them to festivals and concerts. He's even been a guest lecturer at Berklee College of Music and Millikan University.
And then by about 1991 or two, I started recording cylinders.
The phonograph not only plays back, but records.
What acoustic recording is using sound pressure to record with without the aids of microphones or electronics.
As a person speaks or sings into the wide end of a long horn, acoustic energy travels down the funnel. At the base, the concentrated sound puts pressure on a diaphragm that moves a strong needle. It carves grooves into the wax cylinder. The louder the sound, the deeper the cut.
As soon as you are done recording, it's ready to play. It's an instant process.
you have to brush with a camel hair brush the little flakes and shavings.
Bori makes a lot of recordings for other people. Some customers bring pre-recorded songs they want transferred to wax cylinders. But he looks forward to original work. But
I love live recording. It's more involved and not as appreciated when you're just copying things onto them, especially.
He's recorded jazz bands, solo guitarists, and orchestras. Bori pushed his creative limits in a recent project that has received over 4 million views on YouTube.
We recorded, as far as I know, the very first live acoustic heavy metal cylinder. I've looked and I haven't found anybody else who has done that.
As you might imagine, there are very few original cylinders available, so Bori learned how to make his own. It's an elaborate process.
There's like no other place you can really see this being done.
The wax's primary ingredient is stearic acid, which comes from animal fat.
Flakes and smells like crayons.
The wax is heated to over 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Bori then pours it into a mold. The mold is a larger iron cylinder with a spiral core at the center. The timing has to be just right. If the wax cools too quickly, there are bound to be problems with its structure.
I just gotta find out where it is.
The cylinder is then shaved to the right diameter with an even surface. Then it is trimmed to the right length.
I've made about 2,000 pounds of cylinders.
That's more than 5,000 cylinders. The labor-intensive process of molding and shaping the wax tests Bori's patience.
I get burned all the time. It comes with the job, and it's horrible burns. Yeah, we had a failure on this one.
Bori throws out a good portion of the cast cylinders. But today was a good day. He got it right on the second try.
And that looks like a good, successful casting.
Bori is a recording enthusiast. He's always on the lookout for pieces of unique history. Across the street from the North American Phonograph Company is Blue Jay Way Records, where owner Jim Lovejoy knows Bori well from frequent visits.
Probably within 6 months after we opened our first store, he came in looking for 78s, which nobody looks for 78s.
That refers to a kind of record that spins at 78 revolutions per minute, standard in the early 20th century.
He knows exactly what he's talking about. Extremely knowledgeable on recording techniques, sound waves, anything involved in it. He's just, he knows his stuff.
Bori is kind of a local celebrity. His knowledge and determination has preserved a precious piece of history. The sound that comes out of the phonograph is foreign to most listeners today. It doesn't fill rooms the way a sound system does. But Bori likes it that way.
If you listen, there is a somewhat of a realism to it.
It's the sound of history. Whether recorded yesterday or 100 years ago, Bori says the sound coming off a wax cylinder is authentic.
You'll probably find that there is a intimacy and a closeness in the sound to an actual human without electronic interference. And it's hard for modern people, like you myself, to understand what sound is like without some electrical connection to it.
Reporting for World, wait a minute. What am I doing? I have this on a wax cylinder.
Reporting for World, I'm Caleb Bailey in Princeton, Illinois.
Today is Thursday, July 22nd. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Myrna Brown. Commentator Cal Thomas now on life lessons and spelling.
By any standard, Zyla Avant-Garde is a remarkable 14-year-old girl with a positive and compelling outlook on life. Earlier this month, she became the first African-American to win the highly competitive Scripps National Spelling Bee. She told reporters afterward that she practiced 13,000 words a day. A day! Zyla's remarkable achievement offers many lessons. Here are two. First, hard work. Former President Barack Obama acknowledged the important role that played in a tweet congratulating her. He wrote, "Your hard work is paying off. We're all proud of you." First Lady Jill Biden highlighted the second lesson during her meeting with some of the contestants before the final round. She told them she admired their bravery and confidence. Hard work, bravery, and confidence. Aren't those among the keys to success in life? Human history has proven that, so why don't we make them priorities in school? Zyla Avangard reached a difficult goal through commitment and tenacity. She studied words with a coach for 2 years, and her prize of $50,000 is likely just the beginning. If she remains on track, she's bound to achieve other goals. Those include attending Harvard, playing professional basketball, and working for NASA. People who are tenacious, overcome obstacles, and succeed used to be part of the American story, a story we were happy to share to encourage others. What happened to that? Why do we focus less on success and more on envying and penalizing the successful? While Zyla is the first African-American to win the Bee, let's not forget Akilah Anderson, the 11-year-old fictional character played by Kiki Palmer in the 2006 film Akilah and the Bee. The film contains every value we once promoted in America, including the resistance of peer pressure not to achieve, using proper English, and hard work. The movie takes place in South Central Los Angeles in a gang-infested neighborhood. Akilah's school is so poor it can't afford doors on the restroom stalls, but Akilah wins the Bee against all odds. I've seen the film a dozen times, and it always brings tears to my eyes. It serves as an inspiration to help people overcome difficult circumstances. It's also an example of what young people can do when they strive for academic excellence. And now Zyla Avangard has turned that fictional story into reality. After her win, she told the Washington Post, quote, "I'm hoping that in a few years I'll see a whole lot more African-American females, and males too, doing well in the Scripps Spelling Bee. You don't really see too many African-Americans doing too well in spelling bees, and that's a bit sad, because it's a really good thing, and kind of is a gate opener to be interested in education," unquote. Zyla Avangard may be the key to unlock those gates and open them much wider for many more to go through. I'm Cal Thomas.
Tomorrow, John Stone Street joins us for another Culture Friday, and we'll tell you about a popular show for teens that you'll probably want to avoid. That and more tomorrow. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Myrna Brown. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. For the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching. But having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own passions. Go now, in grace and peace.